Multiple states have recently passed or are considering bills that would restrict abortion. An Alabama bill signed into law on Tuesday outlawed almost all abortions with a penalty of up to 99 years in prison for doctors who perform the procedure. Mississippi, Ohio, Georgia, and other states have passed laws that ban abortion after the detection of a fetal heartbeat. Here in Wisconsin, most abortions are banned after 20 weeks of pregnancy. This latest round of legislation is bringing intense debates over abortion rights back into the spotlight. But abortion wasn't always the partisan flashpoint that it is today. Our next guest has studied the history of how the issue has been talked about in our society and politics. Krissa Haugeberg is an assistant professor of history at Tulane University. She's the author of the book Women Against Abortion, Inside the Largest Moral Reform Movement of the 20th Century. Krissa, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, in this day and age, it's hard to imagine abortion not being a key, maybe the key partisan political flashpoint, but that wasn't always the case. Can you take us back to the time before 1973 in Roe versus Wade and talk about how abortion played out in political conversations?
Absolutely. So the initial wave of state regulation that prohibited abortion, except under very narrow circumstances, for example, if a woman's life or health was imperiled, really came into being in the middle of the 19th century. And it coincided with the organization of physicians into the American Medical Association. And one of the very first topics that they took up was abortion. And one thing that was going on is they were seeking to assert control over obstetrics and gynecology, which historically had been controlled by midwives, or in the 19th century, there were many physicians who were called irregulars. And these were practitioners who had some or limited medical training and certainly were not certified. So again, medicine in the United States in the 19th century was largely the Wild West, largely unregulated. So as physicians in the United States were coming into their own and seeking to wrest control over medical provision, they really put their finger on abortion as the issue that they wanted to regulate. And one thing that was happening in the backdrop was that there was a significant uptick in immigration. And one thing that these physicians identified was that white middle-class women's birth rates were declining at the very moment that Irish and Italian women were immigrating to the United States in significant numbers and having very large families. So these physicians excoriated white middle-class women for seeking birth control and abortion and basically contributing to race suicide. So these physicians approached state legislatures and offered that abortion was murder. So using very familiar rhetoric of religion and morals, but that it was sometimes necessary and that it required a trained, certified, well-educated physician in order to distinguish necessary from unnecessary abortions. So they should be the ones to adjudicate that decision. So again, they very deliberately made themselves kind of the arbiter of these laws to determine when it was medically necessary to do so.
And Krissa, as I understand it, as we got closer to Roe versus Wade in the 20th century, the issue turned around in some ways because of medical doctors. Again, can you talk about how this was still seen as more of a medical issue than anything?
Right. So this is what's absolutely fascinating from a historical perspective. Physicians had been among the key drivers, the initiators of anti-abortion legislation in the 19th century. And by the middle of the 20th century, physicians became the key advocates of liberalizing abortion laws because they were the ones who were treating thousands of women showing up in emergency rooms, suffering the effects of self-induced or botched abortions on the underground market. So by the 1960s, abortion had become a major public health emergency.
Talking to Krissa Haugeberg from Tulane University, talking about the history of abortion laws and the politics surrounding them. So after the passage of Roe versus Wade, Krissa, did abortion immediately become a partisan issue, a Republican versus Democrat issue?
So that's interesting. The stakes had begun to become more partisan In the 1960s, when Richard Nixon was running for re-election, he was in a tough battle. And one of his key advisors was Pat Buchanan, a Catholic Republican, who had the idea that it might be effective to court traditionally Democratic Catholics into the Republican Party by creating abortion as a partisan issue. So indeed, Nixon, who had pretty traditionally been pretty pro-choice, he permitted the military to offer abortion services, did an about-face and characterized Governor McGovern as somebody who was pro-choice. And again, this is against the backdrop of the ERA. But the stakes really, really became ratcheted up when Reagan was running for president. So by the late 1970s, the Republican Party added an anti-abortion plank to its official party plank. And over the course of the 1980s, it became a litmus test for people who wanted to get a Republican endorsement or become a judge, for example. But I do want to back up and point out that in the late 1960s, as individual states were liberalizing their abortion laws, at that time, the Republican Party still had many feminists, many pro-choice members. So as individual states decriminalized the procedure, this legislation was just as likely to have been offered by pro-choice Republicans as it was pro-choice Democrats. So the Republican Party was very divided, as was the Democratic Party, which had many Catholics in the 1960s and 1970s. So the lines were not clearly drawn until the 1980s and 90s.
And now we see the lines very clearly drawn. The idea of pro-choice Republicans or pro-life Democrats, it doesn't seem likely to happen nowadays. But does public opinion reflect the partisanship we see at the political level and among activists on both sides of the debate?
Not exactly. So pretty consistently, polling data shows that Americans have been fairly evenly split on the question of abortion since 1973. Every once in a while, there's a slight movement. So for example, when violence overtook the anti-abortion movement in the late 1980s, Americans became more supportive of pro-choice policies. But again, these numbers have always hovered around the 50-50 mark. But when people are asked more detailed questions, for example, do you support strict restrictions on abortion? Most Americans oppose those. So most Americans, and even most people in Alabama, oppose the extremely strict laws going into place. But again, this is a larger question about democracy and representative government that's really afoot right now. So the politics of abortion, no, they don't always reflect the rank-and-file American public opinion.
We're talking to Carissa Hageberg right now, assistant professor of history at Tulane University, about how our public and political debates about abortion have changed over time, as many states are now passing new restrictions on abortion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen the public conversation about abortion change during your lifetime? To what do you attribute this partisan intensity around the issue? Do you think anything gets missed when abortion gets talked about in political circles? Do you view this as a driving issue, the driving issue, when you're casting a vote? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Carissa Hageberg, assistant history professor at Tulane University, author of Women Against Abortion, Inside the Largest Moral Reform Movement of the 20th Century. You can join in as we talk about changing attitudes toward abortion and the politics of abortion over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you seen this debate change over your lifetime? Have you seen it become more partisan and polarizing, maybe even within your circle of friends, family members, others you know? Call 800-642-1234. Carissa, before we go to our callers, as we mentioned, more and more states now passing restrictions, some states moving in the other direction now. Why now? Why this flurry of states taking action on their abortion laws?
I think one could argue that we see a very emboldened anti-abortion movement, particularly since Justice Kavanaugh joined the Supreme Court. There is a sense among some anti-abortion activists that this is the time that they can be very straightforward with their fetal protective legislation, and that it's more likely to sustain a challenge than ever before. So again, these laws are designed to be challenged, and it just shows how emboldened anti-abortion activists are in this moment.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Kimberly on the line in Appleton. Kimberly, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Kimberly?
I'm not so sure if this is a pro-choice or a pro-life issue. I look at this as a women's rights issue, a woman's right to her own body and a woman's right to be able to choose her own health care and to make decisions for herself. Men get to make their own choices. Men get to make their own choices for their health care and make their own decisions. Women should be able to do the same.
Kimberly, thanks a lot for that call. And Carissa, Kimberly sums up the argument, one of the core arguments, I think, on the pro-choice side of things, that this is an issue of women's autonomy. People arguing for abortion restrictions, their core issue is this is a life morally equivalent to a human. Given those two positions, I mean, is there really a middle ground once you start to stake out those positions?
Right. And this is what makes the issue difficult. I mean, forcing women to continue with pregnancy has historically and in the present does set women up for a range of health issues that men will never face. And this is something that feminists have been articulating since the 1960s, that this is an inherently gendered experience, and that women ultimately are the ones who suffer from higher rates of complications from pregnancies, from maternal mortality. And so, again, this has been a key point of feminist thought since before the 1960s, but really took flight in the 1960s, arguing that women will never be able to fully participate as equal economic and social citizens without the right to control their bodily integrity and their bodily autonomy.
Thanks for that call, Kimberly. We're talking to Carissa Haugeberg, assistant history professor at Tulane University, looking at the changing shape of abortion politics and the debate in the United States. Back to your calls. Matt is with us in Lodi. Matt, hi.
Hello. I think that some of the changing attitudes towards abortion are somewhat related and centered around the advancements in medical technology, specifically ultrasound. If you look back at some of the debates during Roe versus Wade, we heard that this is a collection of cells. It's not an actual person. It doesn't look like a person. And now that we've got 4D ultrasound where we can see in very distinct detail what that developing embryo, that developing life looks like at different stages, a lot of people have to reevaluate that what happens during an abortion is ending a life. And at what point do we say that that person or that life or that embryo is developing? And while it resides within the mother, it is a distinct and unique person. Analogous to after the child's born, can we say, I don't want to take care of this child anymore. I didn't ask for this, so therefore I want to kill the child.
Matt, thanks for the call. Carissa, have you seen medical technology and these more sophisticated views of a developing embryo, as Matt says, changing attitudes on this issue?
Well, without a doubt, there is a vibrant scholarship on the role of changing technology and in particular ultrasound, especially on anti-abortion strategies. So, for example, many states now require women to be given the opportunity to look at ultrasound images of the fetus. Often they have to do it 48 hours before they can get the actual abortion. But again, this doesn't exactly go in concert with what we know about the medical history of abortion. So, for example, an abortion is no safer because a woman has viewed that image. There's no evidence to suggest that women are impressionable or unsure of their decision when they make the appointment for an abortion. So again, by and large, these policies are designed to pressure or shame women into not going through with the decision they've already made when they've called and made that appointment. So again, These laws are not born out of any medical necessity.
Thanks for that call. Carissa, in our last minute or so, abortion became a political issue. Now it seems like it's almost become the political issue in a lot of ways. Do you see it as a dominant issue for many voters and politicians now?
Yes. And one thing, when we think about abortion politics historically, although the partisan nature of the debate has changed over time, one thing that's remained pretty constant is that this debate flares up when we socially have anxieties about gender and women's place in society. And so I think it will be very interesting in 10 or 20 years when historians look back on this period to really think about what anxieties about gender might be expressed in the current flurry of abortion legislation.
Carissa, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Carissa Haugeberg is an assistant professor of history at Tulane University. She joins today for a look at the changing nature of the abortion debate over time. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the life of a bartender. It's part of WPR's ongoing series exploring Wisconsin's complicated relationship with alcohol.
In a city with never-ending bar options, Dell's Bar in downtown La Crosse sticks out. It's been open since 1933, and on any given day, you'll find 40-year regulars, college students, and tourists chatting with each other around an oval-shaped bar. One Sunday afternoon, with the Brewers game and jukebox blaring, two bartenders tell me what Dell's is famous for: Oktoberfest, camaraderie, and Bloody Marys.
One thing about the Bloodies is that I enjoy making Bloodies. I also enjoy Bloody statistics.
Break it down.
The one year, though, was 12,736 Bloody Marys.
I love how you know these numbers.
Sarah Viner, I've worked here for 20 years. I started working because I was working construction, and we started to get laid off, and I found bartending on the off season. I started bartending, and I liked it. I liked the socialness aspect of it.
Thank you. What can I get you, ladies?
Can I just have a regular Bloody Mary, please?
You too.
I love Dell's because, for one, it's kind of like a small community where it's got a lot of character, and everyone here's a family. My name is Bree Ruppel. I worked at Dell's Bar for about 7 years, on and off. A lot of people who aren't in the industry think that it's always about the drinks. And really, when I come into it, I'm thinking, like, how can I craft this experience for the customer to be the best experience they've had? Because they come here, yeah, they come here to drink after work, but, you know, they want to have a good time. They want good stories. They want good music, and otherwise, they can just drink at home. Oh, I love this song. I want to play this.
That's one thing I love about being here, and the music and how good it feels when we bartend together and make the freaking customers just get into it and just, you know, dance, sing.
I think one of the most insulting things that anyone has said to me as a bartender is, well, so what's your real job? How is this not a real job?
It is a real job.
Paid great money. I love what I do. I don't wake up dreading to go to work.
Nope. Never have. You may get the bar occasional burnout, but everybody does. That's normal.
I love working Oktoberfest.
Oktoberfest is crazy anywhere you go in La Crosse that whole weekend.
It's fun, it's fast, it's loud.
The thing is that we have such a tight-knit crew here. I always likened it to going to battle. You know, we're downstairs, like, eating food beforehand. People are listening to music to, like, amp themselves up for the shift, getting ready, and then it's kind of like you're thrown into it. It's nonstop. And then by the end, when we're, like, using a snow shovel to scoop up garbage and cups and everyone has left, we all, like, kind of embrace each other. And it's like, oh, my God, we did it. You know, another year in the books. And that was always one of my favorite parts. You know, like, yeah, it's busy, but oh, it's so worth it. It's so fun.
Yep. I made a lot of good friends through here through the years. Besties.
Yeah.
Including Bree.
You know, we hit it off right off the bat. But then just throughout the years of working the same shifts together, you know, without speaking, without deciding the rules, we just came into this symbiotic dance that we have behind the bar. We know exactly when to move to get out of each other's way. I know by looking at your face what you need, and I can grab it for you. Some people finish each other's sentences. We'll finish each other's drinks, you know, as we're making up.
That story was part of WPR's project, High Tolerance. It's a deep dive into Wisconsin's relationship with alcohol. To hear all the stories, go to WPR.org/alcohol. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You can read more about this story and see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. Coming up Monday on Central Time, we continue our coverage of alcohol in Wisconsin with a look at the penalties for drunk driving in the state. And you can share your thoughts on possible changes to those laws. Wisconsin Republicans are holding their convention this weekend with a look back at their loss of the governor's office and a look ahead at the 2020 presidential elections. Our own Sean Johnson will be there, and he's going to bring us the details from this weekend's convention. Plus, we'll take a look at some of the most intriguing stories from the worlds of science and technology. All that, plus a look at some of the top news of the day. It's coming up Monday here on Central Time.